This is lesson number two, making a decision on whether to initiate treatment. This is Dr. Raymond Chung, Director of Hepatology in the Liver Center, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. The outline for today's talk will start with indications for treatment, consider contraindications to treatment, patient readiness, and timing of treatment for hepatitis C. First, let's consider indications for treatment. The indications for protease inhibitor-based triple therapy for hepatitis C include the presence of chronic hepatitis C virus genotype 1 infection, for which protease inhibitor-based therapy was approved by the FDA. Patients should fulfill criteria for PEG interferon and ribavirin-based therapy. That is to say, they should have well-controlled psychiatric disease, if indeed psychiatric disease is present. No autoimmune diseases should be present that could be exacerbated by the use of interferon. They should be able to tolerate potentially significant degrees of anemia, i.e., there should not be active cardiovascular ischemic coronary disease. They should not be considering pregnancy, given the teratogenic effects of ribavirin. If the patient has cirrhosis, it should be well compensated and should have no evidence of esophageal varices, ascites, or encephalopathy. The patient must also be able to adhere to the treatment goals and monitoring. How do we stage liver disease, and how does that influence our decision-making? In 2013, liver biopsy remains the gold standard for assessing histologic injury and fibrosis associated with chronic hepatitis C. However, we have seen increasing use of non-invasive serum tests. These include the HCV FibroSure test, as it is known in the United States, and the FibroTest, as it is known in Europe. These tests offer reasonable accuracy at the extremes of histologic fibrosis, that is, cirrhosis at one end and normal histology at the other end. The performance is less clear in between. More recently, transient elastography has been FDA cleared in April of 2013. Elastography measures the stiffness of the liver, which is in large measure dictated by hepatic fibrosis. Recent studies and compendiums of studies of FibroScan have revealed that this technique provides excellent positive and negative predictive value for the diagnosis of cirrhosis. Finally, elastography has come in the form of radiologically mediated modalities such as MRI. MRI elastography is increasingly in use at centers across the country and may provide analogous information as transient elastography. What can we learn from liver biopsy? First, histology can tell us much about the severity of hepatitis C. It can reveal much about the degree of inflammation, of course, as well as the stage of fibrosis. It will also reveal to us the presence of other suspected findings, if in fact we do look for those findings, including steatosis, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, as well as evidence of alcoholic steatohepatitis. We may also examine these patients for the presence of alpha-1 antitrypsin disease and potentially autoimmune disease. Unsuspected findings may also be uncovered through a liver biopsy. An excellent example of this would be the finding of granulomatous diseases. What about non-invasive markers of fibrosis? This slide demonstrates the performance of the FibroTest or FibroSure, which is a compendium of five separate serum assays, including total bilirubin, alpha-2 macroglobulin, haptoglobin, gamma-GTP, and apolipoprotein A1. Based on a weighted score of these analytes, the intensity or quantity of measurement has been correlated well with fibrosis stage as shown in this graph. However, as one can see, between stages 0 and 4 on the Medavir scale, there is broad overlap of confidence intervals and therefore limited discrimination for those stages between cirrhosis and a normal biopsy. It's therefore important to understand then that the predictive values are best in excluding cirrhosis or advanced fibrosis generally. The next slide demonstrates the technique underlying the transient elastography, otherwise known as FibroScan. This is a shear wave elastogram in which a probe applied against the intercostal space induces an elastic wave that is transmitted through several spots in the liver. The velocity of the wave is evaluated in a region that is located about 2.5 to 6.5 centimeters below the surface of the skin. This velocity is a reflection of the stiffness or resistance of the liver. Again, a reflection of hepatic fibrosis in large measure, and is reported as a quantitative measurement. Many studies have been conducted regarding the predictive value of FibroScan. And in this slide, a meta-analysis of 50 such studies assessed the overall performance of FibroScan for diagnosing liver fibrosis. The area under the receiver operating characteristic curve, a measure of the accuracy of a given assay, were excellent for significant fibrosis, about 84% or 0.84. For severe fibrosis, 0.89, and for cirrhosis, 0.94. Indicative, then, that the ability of FibroScan to diagnose cirrhosis accurately is excellent. In this regard, the ability to rule in or rule out cirrhosis becomes a very important tool clinically, and one that can be satisfied potentially by the use of this modality, which is very safe. What about contraindications to therapy? Contraindications can be divided to those to peg interferon and those to ribavirin. Uncontrolled neuropsychiatric disease, particularly depression, represent perhaps the most important contraindication to the use of interferon-based regimens. The presence of autoimmune diseases like SLE, sarcoid, and autoimmune hepatitis are also strong contraindications. Pre-existing cytopenias, of course, limit the ability to give marrow-suppressive doses of interferon. And decompensated cirrhosis is a contraindication to interferon because of concerns that it can hasten further deterioration of the liver. Contraindications to ribavirin include the presence of anemia or other hemolytic conditions such as thalassemia, pregnancy given the strong teratogenic effects of ribavirin, and renal failure given the exclusive renal clearance of ribavirin and its very long half-life. What about patient readiness? Patient readiness is extraordinarily important in embarking on a successful course of therapy. It's therefore important to take into consideration several factors as one embarks on a course of PEG interferon ribavirin and protease inhibitor. First and foremost, is this patient a good candidate for PEG interferon ribavirin in the first place? We've reviewed some of those contraindications to interferon ribavirin-based regimens. Are there any potential drug-drug interactions with the patient's current or planned regimens? What about pill burden? There is a considerable pill burden in that the protease inhibitor is given 3 times daily, and that there is, in addition, a food and fat effect with the protease inhibitors. And the requirement for substantial quantities, 20 grams of fat with telaprevir, and a food effect with boceprevir. Patients must be reminded then that they are to take these foods with their protease inhibitors. Of course, we need to have a discussion about the chances of sustained virologic response for the patient, which clearly depends on the treatment naivete of the patient or whether that patient has had a prior unsuccessful experience with PEG interferon and ribavirin, either as a null responder, a partial responder, or a responder relapser. We should also consider how we will apply response-guided algorithms. Is there a strong likelihood based on pretreatment characteristics that this patient will indeed be able to truncate therapy by virtue of there being a rapid responder and their ability to achieve an extended rapid virologic response, often a precondition for for the ability to truncate therapy. What are the risks of treating, given all of the potential adverse events of the triple therapy regimen? And they need to be weighed against the risks of not treating. Much of this, of course, then depends on liver disease staging and what are the stakes for deterioration of the liver in the face of a decision not to treat. And, of course, how will we manage incident adverse events while on these regimens? We need to maximize the message to our patients that they must be prepared for the possibility of temporary hardship while on triple therapy. So let's consider a few of these in greater detail. The evaluation of drug-drug interactions is extraordinarily important as one moves into therapy with a triple regimen containing a protease inhibitor. Both bisaprolimus and talaprolimus are cytochrome P450-3A4 inhibitors. They block the function of this important isoenzyme, which is responsible for the metabolism of many prescription medications. Thus, these drug interactions, by blocking 3A4 activity, may affect blood levels of either the co-administered medication, or in the case of other medications that interact with 3A4, because the protease inhibitors themselves are also substrates, the protease inhibitor levels themselves could be altered. This graph indicates the potential consequences then, as a drug that is considered an inducer of cytochrome P453A4 will decrease the area under the curve of the given drug. Inhibitors, in contrast, of 3A4 would be expected to enhance the area under the curve and increase overall levels of the drug in question. Thus, caution is required with all co-administered medications, and a careful review of FDA-approved label information for interactions must be performed. Therefore, reconciliation of the patient medication list with talaprolimus and bosepivir must occur. Patients should also be reminded they need to communicate new medications started by other healthcare providers, not only recently, but also in the during the administration of this regimen. Fortunately, resources exist that allow fairly straightforward and rapid access to information about potential drug interactions, such as those found at hcvadvocate.org and hep-druginteractions.org. So let's consider some examples of drug-drug interactions of important classes of prescription medications. One such class are lipid-lowering agents overall, and these include predominantly statin drugs. It turns out that lovastatin and simvastatin, along with atorvastatin, and particularly in its interaction with talaprolimus, have significant increases in the area under the curve for these statins in the presence of talaprolimus. Each of these medicines should not be co-administered with protease inhibitors, and in the case of atorvastatin, should not be co-administered with talaprolimus. With bosepivir, which causes a more modest increase in statin levels for atorvastatin, titration of the dose should take place, in any event, that dose should not exceed 20 milligrams daily of atorvastatin. Pravastatin is not extensively metabolized by 3A4. A modest increase was caused by bosepivir co-administration. Therefore, it is recommended, as shown here in yellow, to be used with caution and to monitor for statin-related myopathy. Rosuvastatin is a similar recommendation to be used with caution. Fibrates, another version of lipid-lowering agents, do not have clinically significant interactions expected, at least in theory. Therefore, their co-administration is okay. What about antihypertensive drug-drug interactions? It turns out that ACE inhibitors and diuretics, two of the most commonly used classes, do not experience cytochrome P450 metabolism, and therefore no adjustments are required. In contrast, angiotensin receptor blockers and beta-adrenergic blockers are metabolized in part, at least some of these are metabolized by 3A4, including irbesartan and losartan in the ARB class, and their doses should be considered for reduction, therefore in combination with bosepivir or talaprolimus. And so too are carvedilol and nebivolol, metabolized by 3A4, and their doses should be considered for reduction during co-administration with protease inhibitors. Calcium channel blockers also experience, by virtue of their reliance on CYP3A4 for metabolism, should also be considered for dose reduction, particularly of amlodipine with telaprevir. Patient education is absolutely critical to success with peginterferon, ribavirin, and protease inhibitor therapy. We should consider and review CDC recommendations as they relate to sexual transmission. No changes in current sexual practices are recommended for stable monogamous couples. Avoidance of pregnancy during and for up to 6 months after ribavirin-based therapy, owing to the long half-life of ribavirin, a significant teratogen, are critical. Thus, two forms of barrier contraception are recommended. Oral contraceptives, on the other hand, are not recommended under these circumstances, particularly in view of the fact that they too are felt to interact with protease inhibitor therapies, which, by virtue of their 3A4 effects, appear to lower overall hormonal levels of oral contraceptives. We should also apply some first principles of primary care hepatology. Avoidance of cofactors that would enhance and accelerate hepatic fibrosis progression, including alcohol, to reduce or to minimize steatosis by achieving and or maintaining a normal body mass index where possible. Copathogen testing for HIV and HPV are mandatory, as are hepatitis A and hepatitis B immunization in those persons who are non-immune. Of course, for those patients with cirrhosis and even bridging fibrosis, HCC screening is warranted. And for established cirrhotics, variceal screening should take place according to recommendations of the AASLD. Treatment decisions for HCV protease inhibitor-based therapy should be weighed between pros and cons. In support of the use of protease inhibitor-based therapy are the observations that protease inhibitors substantially increase the chance of achieving sustained response across all patient groups, including naive and treatment-experienced patients. PIs, again, because of response-guided therapy principles, can shorten the duration of therapy in many, and in some cases, most patients with response-guided, meeting response-guided therapy benchmarks. It's absolutely clear that successful treatment improves long-term natural history of hepatitis C, including feared morbidity or mortality related to chronic hepatitis C. Against therapy, though, are several factors. These are complicated regimens with challenging sets of adverse events and drug-drug interactions, as we have discussed. The likelihood of response is tethered to the likelihood of responsiveness to interferon. The risk of resistance, if therapy fails, it can be assumed that these patients will be enriched for protease inhibitor-resistant variants. And we do not know yet with full certainty what kind of impact this will have on future therapeutic regimens, particularly those containing protease inhibitors. Suboptimal response rates may still be seen in certain populations, including prior PEG ribavirin null responders, as well as persons with advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis in particular. We also have relatively little data in special populations of patients, including HCV-HIV co-infection, patients status post-liver transplantation, and persons with decompensated cirrhosis. It's absolutely clear as we embark in consideration of triple therapy that several factors be worked into that discussion and debate. HCV genotype, fibrosis stage are critical, as are considerations of IL-28B genotype, age, ALT, presence of co-pathogens and accelerants like HIV co-infection. But there are other important considerations as well, including personal plans and the interruption of the quality of life of patients with upcoming personal plans like marriage, pregnancy, family and other support, patient attitude, occupation, and the intensity of work required for those occupations are also important factors in terms of deferring therapy or moving ahead at present. Extrahepatic features and symptomatic disease may push the envelope in terms of moving closer to a more immediate decision to treat. And of course, contraindications, relative or absolute, may indeed push the decision indefinitely for a patient as far as triple therapy is concerned. And perhaps just as importantly in the mix is the understanding that the new therapy pipeline looms with many potentially promising interferon-sparing regimens that will be successful and of short duration with, of course, minimum in the way of adverse events. Thus, as we think about timing of therapy, we need to factor in liver disease stage and the likelihood that that natural history will play out significantly into complications and downstream consequences in the immediate future, the presence of symptoms, and certainly the input of the patient preference about being treated at this moment and their influence on guiding treatment decisions. Deferral of therapy may very well be reasonable then for patients with minimal to even moderate liver disease. Initiation of therapy should be considered perhaps most strongly for patients with advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis. But again, deferral is increasingly an option for more advanced disease since all oral highly potent direct acting antiviral regimens loom imminently. In summary then, the indications and contraindications for triple therapy are similar to those for prior peg interferon ribavirin regimens, given the importance of peg interferon ribavirin as a backbone for triple therapy. The staging of liver disease is a key factor in decisions to treat, since the threshold to start is now rising with newer direct-acting antiviral agents on the horizon and the chance to achieve freedom from interferon and retaining success. Many other factors, though, will influence the decision to start triple therapy. More intensive education is required for triple therapy, particularly regarding adherence, adverse effect monitoring, and drug-drug interactions.